Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures.
Welcome to Big Adventures with Brian Durker, and today we've got Pete Resnick, an old friend, and he's also an old friend, one of the legends of Grand Canyon in his own mind and my mind. But we're real lucky to have Pete. He's a treasure trove of the history of commercial river running down there, knows a lot of stuff that we don't, but we're going to find out. Welcome, Pete.
Good to be here.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you. And normally what I'll do is start out with, kind of get to know Pete a little bit by finding out about his childhood a little bit. And I know you grew up in Palisades.
Actually, Palos Verdes.
Oh, Palos Verdes, excuse me. That's a bad me.
No, common mistake.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. What year were you born?
1950.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was a good year. It's the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. I mean, we had the best.
Yeah, no, it was the golden age. Was that a good place to grow up?
Yeah, I lived about 5 minutes from the beach. And, my folks were really outdoorsy. They wanted to go run rivers all over the California area. We did the Russian River and Colorado River by needles and, canoes.
Oh, cool.
So,
and what did your dad do and mom do?
Well, my dad worked. He was a financial advisor or a fundraiser for nonprofits.
Uh-huh.
He worked on the Cedar Chest and Red Feather, stuff like that. They were like Salvation Army kind of fundraising
entities,
I guess. And then later on he did stuff like the Punahou School over in Hawaii. He worked for them, helping them raise money. He was an idea guy. He put out fires and was a fixer for stuff.
Uh-huh. He sounds super interesting.
Well, he was a smart guy, and he met my mom in L.A., and her sister Miriam was in Flagstaff. And, I was going to say the reason I brought them up is they were on the river trip where they came upon when Shorty Burton had flipped and died. And they were with Dennis Massey on a hatch trip. So they were the earliest river runners in Grand Canyon on my family.
Oh, that's so interesting. They were on a hatch trip with Dennis Massey.
Right.
And, we'll get to the early hatch days and the Vernal days in a second. But let's go back to Palos Verdes. You went clear through high school there.
I did.
And you were a football star?
No, I played water polo. But I left at senior year. I missed the graduation because I was on my second hatch trip.
Oh, wow. So you got into it before you got out of high school and another life ruined by Grand Canyon. So then after high school, did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to UC Santa Barbara for 2 years. And then they shut down when Ohio had the four dead in Ohio. They shut down all the colleges. And so I ended up just running the river full season and skiing in Switzerland and stuff like that.
It sounds like a similar story to me. I went to college for a while, but like I say, we were young lives ruined by the canyon, and that's where we still are. But those were the days you were going on European ski trips and stuff, and who were you doing that with?
Well, with Breck.
Breck O'Neill.
Yeah, I met him in college when I was freshman in college, and Ross Garrison as well.
Right.
Breck made a deal with me. He said he'd get me into skiing, I'd get him into river running. And so he came out and worked for Hatch. Later on, of course, he had an illustrious career up in the Mad River boat trips in Jackson Hole.
Right.
But we went to Switzerland and Bart Henderson, Stan Boer, Dave Bledsoe, Rodney Paulson.
Golly, those
that's
names.
Ratchet from Vernal.
Yeah.
They were all there, and we were 21 years old.
You took that country by storm. Whale wasn't involved with that.
No, he never did come over.
He never came over, but did you learn to ski?
Yeah, Breck took me to the highest, tallest mountain there on a tram, and then he left. He took off. He'd been skiing a few years before me, so I survived, and I've never had great form because of that, but I could go fast.
Well, you know, you really don't have good form, but you always keep up. I can attest to that. And so you got, let's talk a little bit about the early days of Hatch. Like when you were first working for Hatch, you guys were kind of based out of Vernal, right?
Well, Hatch was based out of Vernal.
I mean, yeah, but you'd go up there and spend time in Vernal. And
in my first year, I did a trip in March of 68, and it was with Cecil Massey and Dennis Massey and a guy named Lee Richmond and Dave Bledsoe.
Right.
And that was my magic trip, as you might call it. And
yeah. Yes, I have many times.
I remember more about that trip than many of the other trips I ever did later.
Oh, yeah, that's how it goes.
But after one trip, I went up to Vernal and ran the Lador and the Yampa.
Yeah, because they'd spin you guys around. They'd like, you'd do some stuff up there, and then they'd bring you down to Grand Canyon. It was a really cool early career you had with Hatch.
A single set of oars on a 33 full of people. You'd bounce along the side if it was windy.
Oh, yeah. No, I can't even imagine. I mean, and, you know, for the listener, a 33 is a big donut, and we're still using a similar-looking boat for the modern boats. We're building new ones now, but it was Army surplus, and let's talk about some of the boat styles a little bit as far as what Hatch was doing. Well, this boat, probably they were 13, 14-foot oars. You're back there rowing this just ridiculously huge boat with a bunch of people on it down. You know, it wasn't like really feasible to detail a real intricate run with those things. It was kind of aim and fire, I would imagine, huh?
Well, they used to cut them down, take out the middle sections, and call it a shorty.
Yeah, which was 28 feet or something, right?
People go, all right, I get to row the shorty.
But those were incredible boats. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but then, like in Grand Canyon, I remember the mousetrap rigs where you had a motor and a guy rowing. And I remember the tail draggers where the transom was hanging off over the back of the boat.
We called them outside rigs.
Outside rigs.
As opposed to an inside rig when they had removed the floors and had the motor protected by the back rubber.
Yeah, and also you didn't have to bail out like 5,000 gallons of water.
Exactly. We would actually pull the motor and tie it up on, and then row with two stations in Grand for Hance, Lava, sometimes Crystal.
Yeah, but you still probably ate that hole pretty big time in Crystal, huh?
Well, we'd cut to the right. Hatch was famous for always cutting around the big stuff. Some of the other companies would go right down the gut of it and, you know,
That's how Neff was. And when I was running triple rigs with Neff, we'd just quarter the boat, you know, to where it was kind of a odd angle and run right down through there. It was unbelievable. And once again, for the listener, the pre-83 Crystal had this gigantic hole just outside of Slate Creek that comes in from the left. I mean, it was a monster. And the higher the water, the bigger it was. But 83, that big 100,000 changed that rapid quite a bit.
Yeah, it moved the rock finally.
Yeah. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about the Hatch organization. It was Ron and Ted running it, right?
Ted and Don.
I mean, excuse me, Don, not Ron.
They were running it. Then Don took the northern river.
Yeah, they split it up.
Ted just wanted Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and he took Grand Canyon. And But back in the early days, they were both running it down here. And, you know, it was kind of a brother, Hatch brothers.
You never saw either one of them on the river, though. I don't think I did even once. I know he took the Kennedys down, and there's photos of him with Bobby Kennedy and whatnot. And so he did go down, you know, on special trips.
Yeah, yeah, PR trips.
But it was a great company to work for. Ted was a hoot.
Oh, yeah, no, Ted, boy, I always loved showing up there at Vermilion Cliffs Bar. We'd all meet up there, and Ted bought all the pitchers of beer. That guy taught me a lot about throwing big parties, too.
Like Georgie's 80th.
Like Georgie's 80th, or how about the 50th, where I hiked all the people out.
You came up Soap.
Came up Soap Creek with my whole group.
That was pretty impressive.
Pretty crazy party.
You left at like 4 in the morning.
It was tough. It was
tough. To cook breakfast.
Well, it's even more complicated than that, but we won't go into those details right now. And then as you went along, you and your father got involved with Arizona River Runners and Fred Burke. Tell us a little bit about that, Pete.
Well, my dad was my mom grew up in Salt Lake City, and she got to see her brothers do Boy Scout hiking and whatnot, and the girls were always taught to do home ec. And so she said, when she broke out of, Salt Lake, she said, I'm going to be going river trips and stuff and outdoors. And so she was really the force. And my dad kind of accommodated her and became a Sierra Club trip leader and brought these huge trips out. And Hatch was the concessionaire, the biggest one in the canyon. And Fred Burke and my dad were the same age, and they got to be friends because Fred would run some trips.
Fred was working for Hatch.
He was actually a USGS guy on the cable car there at Lee's Ferry. My dad would request Fred. He'd say, can we get Fred to go down? And so they became friends. That's when they later started Arizona River Runners. He included my dad in the initial
holding.
The initial startup of that thing. And I didn't work for them the first year. Tom Moody did. I worked for, worked for Hatch until 72, and that's when I started with ARR.
Okay, yeah. And then ARR, they had that nice, wonderful Vermilion Cliffs property.
The company bought it, and Tom and I were involved when we bought that from the Seeleys.
Right, the Seeleys, yeah.
That was interesting. It had a beautiful tasting water. It still does. It's not very much of it. So I worry about that drying up, but
thus giving the name Bicker Creek.
What do you call it? Bicker? Yeah.
Bicker Creek instead of Badger Creek. And for the listener, the Vermilion Cliffs is this incredible property, and there's a spring that comes out from behind the property, and there's a lodge there and a little hotel, single rooms. It's still there. It's still in operation. Brady Black just acquired that property.
Yeah, I heard that.
But it was the place to go. I mean, you guys had such a cool thing at ARR. Everybody had one of the hotel rooms. He put up all his boatmen at this place. He cooked them meals. The boathouse was right next door, because it was, back in those days, very few people were around there. And to have people come and work a season, being based out of Vermilion Cliffs, you needed to provide for them and stuff like that. And Fred and Carol did a great job of taking care of all the boatmen and all the other companies. We'd go up there and hang out at Vermilion Cliffs and watch old Jimmy Hall hustle people playing pool and on and on and on down the line.
On and on.
It's a legendary, sacred place.
Dick Clark was around in those days.
Yeah, he's still there.
I believe so.
Yeah, I think he's got a house still there. Amazing. I haven't seen Dick in quite some time, but he worked for Cross Tours, but before that he was with Fort Lee, wasn't he?
That's right. And then Arizona River Runners after that.
We can go on and on about these different individuals that jump from company to company, but you were right in the thick of things. And then as things went, Fred ended up taking over the whole ownership of the company. How'd that go?
Well, Tom and I wanted to run dories, and Fred was against it. He made a lot more money with motor rigs, and so little difference of
aesthetics.
Yeah, and so, Tom and I moved on, and Tom went to Dick McCallum's company.
Yeah, he started working with me over at Grand Canyon Youth Expeditions.
And I started R&O with Breck, because Fred had actually worked with the Wallapai tribe to start their river business, to run the dailies down from the overnights from Diamond down with Ronnie Beecher. And they did a training thing with a lot of those the locals. So Breck and I, when I left Arizona River Runners, we were sitting in the hot tub with my old man. And he goes, why don't you guys start a river company down from Diamond down? And so we approached the tribe and we got a contract, and that's when R&O River Guides
started. Go with the flow. Go with R&O. And
we had a good time doing that. It was interesting. And
you guys had big full trips and stuff. I saw you guys down on the lake a few times where it seemed like you had multiple boats and lots of people.
Our initial trip was 100 blind children from Los Angeles. My dad helped line that one up. We had all the characters.
Wow, is that right? 100 blind kids.
And a lot of these guys who went on to become famous you know, trailblazing river runners. Rich Bangs worked for me.
Yep.
Tim Means.
Yep.
Others, you know, Stan Bohr, and, you know, they just, it was
on. R&O, it was, and how long were you in operation
just
with
R&O? 2 years.
Yeah, it was only 2 years.
Yeah.
But it was something to behold, for sure. And then how'd that all kind of culminate?
It kind of petered out at one point. We went up to, I brought all my equipment up to Miriam's property out there in Flagstaff. And then I, you know, kind of did freelancing. And I worked for a lot of I worked for Oars and Wilderness World and Dick McCallum.
Yeah,
and
you worked for us for a bunch of trips.
And had a great time freelancing. And then I started doing the science trips when you got that contract going. And that
worked for me.
I never went back to commercial trips after that.
No, that was the heyday of science back then. And we did those neat teacher's trips.
Stan Buse.
With Stan Buse and Steve Carruthers. Steve Carruthers.
Yeah, those were great.
Those were great trips. And we had little projects for all the teachers. And those were long trips. They were like 18-day trips.
You guys were someone was renting my 33. I owned a 33.
I was. I was renting
it. But you got to run the ichthyofighter.
I ran the ichthyofighter, and that 33 was a real key part of those trips.
Really haul the people.
Haul the people, things were a little PC in my early contracting years. I had like 6 motors on a trip with 3 boats, and there'd be 6 different manufacturers of the motors.
Those were
borrowed and I stole for our equipment on all that stuff.
Those were great trips. I learned a lot of working with the scientists. They never complained. They were getting paid way more than me.
Everybody was. If I was the one that hired you, everybody was getting paid more than you were. Well, those were the great days. And, you know, it's interesting, other than R&O, all these players are still in place. We're still down there doing river trips. I mean, it's like ARR, I work for them now.
Right.
And Hatch, my nephew, works for Hatch. And, you know, it's just amazing. Just the other day, I was sitting at Diamond Creek and saw your son paddle by doing a wallaby trip.
Right. He's down there working,
loving
it.
Yeah, really cool stuff.
It's a great lifestyle.
It's still a great thing. Yeah. But those early days were the heyday. It was so raw, the profession. And it's wonderful to share these stories with you. Now, when we continue to talk about Grand Canyon, the science trips really were a major part of my life. For 30 years, I was doing that contracting stuff. And like you say, you never looked back to the commercial stuff so much after we got into that stuff, doing scientific logistics and support and technical boat driving and stuff like that. But I understand you're going to be doing a trip on the 15th for the Park Service through Scotty Davis, through SABA, who has the contract, one of the contracts for the Park Service. And are you excited about that or what?
I'm excited about it. They said it's a trip custom made for me. It's like 3 layover days at Shinnamoo. They're trying to move some new locations for the humpback chub.
Yeah, those translocations are a big deal. And I think the fish are, I think it's been fairly successful there at Shinnamoo. The humpback chub, for the listener, it's a... some interesting things happening with that species. It's an endangered species, and where the humpback chub swims, research money follows in its wake. But they took some fish out of Little Colorado and planted them back in a few side streams. I think the most successful one being Shinnamoo down there at one.
Or Havasu.
I think, is Havasu more successful than Shinnamoo?
Except the bass, when they can get up through the dam and come up, they eat them. So when the water's really warm, the bass can survive.
And it seems like later in the season, when I was doing the fisheries work, we'd pick up more striped bass later in the season and stuff. But anyway, they're moving these small fish into these tributary streams, Shinnamoo being a major one, Havasu being the other major one. And so it remains to be seen the success rate of these fish. But the big story, I was talking to Mike Yard the other day, Pete, and the big story is the numbers of humpback chub that we're seeing in the lower Western Canyon. And it might be more plentiful down there as far as nutrients. It might be a temperature-driven thing. But there's obviously spawning going on down in the lower canyon where when the humpback chub was listed and we were doing all that early work, it was pretty much contained around Little Colorado where they were having successful spawn, where something's changed there. And the numbers are really actually remarkable.
I've heard that.
Down in the western end. So it'll be an interesting story to watch unfold in regards to this endangered species. But it's a pretty exciting thing to see that fish doing so well. And that you're going to be right in the thick of that fisheries work. So I think you're going to have a ball down there.
I'll lend him a hand wherever I can. But my main job is just to run the boat, you know.
You want to make that clear, huh? And so I want to talk a little bit also about, you've been, of all the friends I've got that have had a camera in their hand all these years, and I'm kind of the same way. I've always, since I was a kid down there, had a camera. And you always are kind enough to send me these, when you go through your files, you send me these classic old photos from the old days. You must have a tremendous file of photographs because you've been taking pictures for a really long time.
Boxes and boxes of mostly 3x5 and 4x6 prints, which is perfect because I can take a picture of it with my iPhone, it just grabs it, and then I can immediately email it or text it to you or whoever's in it or whoever might be interested in it. And the new technology has kind of caught up with the old technology, and it's really easy to... And I enjoy, looking through the old pictures.
And you can scan the old print. I am a little worried about just it being the digital world because you can lose your digital records from computer to computer where there's something to be said about a printed photograph. Are you still shooting film at all?
No, never.
It's all digital now. Yeah. And same thing with me. I'm not shooting any.
No.
And you can't even get it.
No, there's no reason.
Processed.
The cameras, the phone is better than my Nikon camera. That's crazy.
I'm thinking some people will be really interested in the stuff you have because it's not only you're an artist and a sensitive one at that, but it's an archive of the ages. It's the old Hatch days or it's the... And I've got a bunch of stuff from the 83 flood or the Little Colorado runs or, there's all this stuff I think would be valuable to people down the road to see how it was the old days.
Dave Bledsoe had a Leica that he had borrowed from someone. And so he took a lot of old time pictures before I ever got into it.
Oh, is that who got you into it?
No, but he got pictures that I can't believe he's got these shots. Stuart Reeder has pictures also.
Yeah, Stuart Reeder's another one that has phenomenal.
Dark Canyon before Glen Canyon Dam.
Actually, in the latest BQR, Stuart actually submitted a few of his photographs, this latest BQR, so that's something to look out for. Where we need to go now, it's an interesting conversation. Here we are in the Southwest, you guys, listeners, and today's water is like the value of yesterday's oil. And water is becoming more and more valuable in every way, shape, and form in this arid climate. We're in a long drought. Look at California. Everywhere is going on. Well, Pete, you've got a water company. Yeah, and you have an enclave out there.
Mountain Dell Water.
And tell us a little bit about what goes along with being in a small community and being a water company.
It makes me feel useful. I think it just doesn't make any money. It's a joke at that because it all goes to APS for pumping it. But I feel like I'm needed, and I it gives me a good feeling.
You're bringing water to the people, Pete. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Drinkable, good water, and as long as it. I can keep this old stuff working.
And what is your source? Do you have just one well or do you have several wells?
We get two, and they're about a quarter mile in the ground.
Wow.
So they're deep. So it's pretty good water. I think Donnie Perry is my water guru. He says that...
That's my brother-in-law, by the way.
He says that it's mined. It's not being replenished. This deep water is 2,000 years old.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long it'll last.
As you monitor it, have you seen a drop in your water level?
I have. And they put a huge well out at Fort Tuthill here in Flagstaff for the city.
And you immediately saw impact from that?
No, I don't know. It's hard to judge, but I think that's affecting me a little bit. They're pumping a ton of water out of this, right in the middle of the horse track.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
And how long ago did they put that down?
A couple years ago.
Well, you know, it's a great subject in that it's so critical. And you watch the growth of this small Western community, like Flagstaff, is blowing up right now. They're building all these big buildings, and you're just wondering, where is the water coming from, right?
Well, they've invented low flush toilets.
There's improvements in conservation, for sure, in how the water is used. I think a lot of people are pretty conscious of that in this
Flagstaff
community.
Is a conscious town.
Pretty conscious mm-hmm. about it. But, you know, look at what's going on in the valley, this massive growth. I mean, that aquifer is probably going to be in trouble.
I think they've got ways to pump the used water back down into the wells.
Uh-huh.
Assuming that the rocks will filter out any impurities and... I don't know how well it's working, but they're doing that in Scottsdale and other places.
Recharging it with post-treated water. Yeah. Well, you know, it's pretty amazing what they can do as far as cleaning water up. I mean, there's some real problems with chemicals that they can't get out of there. So
pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals seem to be a real culprit as far as processing water.
It's worked pretty well for the snowball, though.
It's been a great thing. And for a lot of the grass around Flagstaff that the city maintains, it's all that water. And it's a good use of it. You know, I mean, it's been a wonderful thing for us skiers, for sure. What they've done up there is phenomenal. But back to your water company, what sort of infrastructure elements do you face having a water company? Are you in ownership of all the pipes?
Up to the meters.
Up to the meters?
And there's mains that all run through the whole area. And I've got storage tanks and pumping equipment.
Yeah.
It's not that big. It's not rocket science. It's clean work.
Uh-huh.
But
and how is the infrastructure that you have holding up? Because how old is it? It's got to be 50, 60 years old by now.
We replaced one of the streets. They were all rusted out, and we replaced them with fancy PVC. And a guy named Cisco helped me do that, and I never had a problem since. So, but I do keep a backhoe on hand in case I pop a leak somewhere. And my neighbors are kind enough to tell me when they see a leak.
And is it true that if you have a leak, you dig straight down from where you find the water, surface
generally,
water?
Generally, it goes straight up.
Unless
you're in Doney Park where there's so many cinders, it doesn't come up at all. You can't even spot it.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense because it's so porous, the open porous cinders.
Well, that water system has 44 square miles. So there, you know, luckily that's backed by the county.
Yeah, that's a big water company over there. Who owns that one?
Well, the county.
The county owns it.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so they've got a little bit more resource behind it. But do you know how many private water companies there are in the area? Are there any other ones other than you in the area?
There's one on West 66 over there, West Valley, I think it's called. That's about, and Mountain Air is one.
Oh, Mountain Air is a private one, too. And do you know those guys that run those operations?
Cool. They're cool.
They're good guys. Yeah, you guys are like a little club, right?
Yeah, not too many of us around. But
bringing water to the people, brother.
Yeah.
Water to the people. I love that. You know, family-wise, and I will just touch on this, you have a brother, Nick, and we lost Nick some years ago. And was he your partner with the...
Yep.
With the
In everything.
In the whole deal. Kind of explain what you have out there. How big of a operation do you have? You've got a bunch of rentals.
Got some rentals and the water system. And we did a subdivision by University Heights, and that was and they built, we'd let contractors build, you know, different kind of homes there. And then when my brother passed away, we sold the phase two of University Terrace to Capstone Homes.
Oh,
okay. And all the homes kind of look the same now. They built them themselves. And I think ours is a prettier subdivision.
You've got a beautiful home and subdivision.
The subdivision, yeah. But
so that's been a successful element. Well, another talent you have that I've always appreciated is your attention to music. And are you still playing the guitar?
I've fooled with the guitar. I plateaued in quality of work years ago. But I know all the artists, and the history is very intriguing to me. I've read all the biographies of, you know, David Crosby and
the rock stars.
You know,
Jim Morrison. I think you gave me "Nobody Gets Out of Here Alive."
Yes, I look at what I did in my life when these guys were doing their thing. I read Keith Richards' book recently, which is fantastic. It's called Life.
Oh, I'll have to recommend that one up. Yeah, okay.
But, you know, his life was so much different than mine. I mean, he, you know, when you're these rock stars, I don't think I would have wanted to do that. They don't have any privacy.
Well, you'd be dead by...
That's true.
Unless potential, you're Keith Richards. Unless you're Keith Richards. But you were right in the thick of the greatest... what I like is I see all these kids listening to that music. It's still extremely popular. Well, it's such an important artistic base that happened during those years.
It was the 60s. It was when a lot of stuff was going on, the change of, you know, society. People got freed up for various reasons. And it was after Elvis, but before the Monkees.
Right.
And that was the golden age. It was only a couple of years.
No, and you were lucky, and you were on the coast, and you were in a great position. There's a great story. You were at a Vietnam protest, and somebody tore your beads off.
Well,
tell us that story.
It was we were in UC Santa Barbara, Isla Vista, living there, and my friend walked down the street at night after curfew, and my friend Breck and I decided to go collect him and bring him back. Well, we got arrested right behind my friend, and they handcuffed us, and they put a tag on my hippie beads, and I was able to wiggle out of the handcuff, and I said, "Let me take my beads off," and the guy goes, he jumped, and the beads just went all over the place. That was a wild time, I'll tell you what.
How long were you in the slammer for that?
Overnight, but I'm sitting there with Breck, and he goes, "Man, what are we going to do?" I go, "God, I wish I was on the river right now." And he goes, "What's that?" You know?
Really? When you introduced the river
to him? We went out, and I got him a job.
Enough of this conflicting society. Let's go down where nature is our best friend,
but,
right?
But they erased it from our records and everything. I mean, there were thousands of students were arrested. I mean, this was when they killed the four people in Kent State.
In
Isla Vista, they burned the Bank of America. It was, you know...
There was turmoil, and it was a very unpopular war. I came a little too close. How'd you get out of going to Vietnam?
I had a student deferment.
Uh-huh.
And then when they had the lottery system, I got a big number, and that's when we went to Switzerland.
Uh-huh. Good for you. You know,
it was luck of the draw.
Yeah. Those poor guys that ended up in Vietnam, it didn't do them any favors, and we know a lot of them.
I was on Whale's first trip. Fresh out of Vietnam, he shows up on a hatch trip, and he was just a young kid. You know, he was older than me, but I was even younger. But Whale became a boatman, one of the most famous boatmen on the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, there's about five or six things named after him. He lived with me for years, and he was a dude. You guys that are listening, you hear Whale come up quite often in these interviews that I've got, because he was a piece of work. But he was a tail gunner for three tours.
On a helicopter.
Tail gunner on a helicopter.
For 7 months or something, he did that.
And yeah.
He was never the same after that, I'm sure.
No,
Jerry Hughes knew him when he was a little kid. And, you know, and Whale got a little bit hardened or numbed to some things that
yeah.
I can't even imagine. But he was a phenomenal guy. And
there's a great organization with his namesake, the Whale Foundation, and they're there to help people assimilate to society after they've been boatmen for a long time. And it's been a real great organization for this community, and they've done some great things. But it's in his namesake. I don't know how he'd feel about it, but he wouldn't play the martyr very good, but it's a proud thing here
so
in this
many,
community.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing a wonderful, wonderful thing. Let's talk a little bit about, just your perception of the growth of Flagstaff, the growth. I know how much Grand Canyon and the land and the world means to you, the natural world and stuff. What's your impression of where we're at right now with all this growth? And is there hope for us down the line? Or I've asked that question to a lot of my guests, and there's usually some optimism, but a lot of despair in their observations of where we're headed. What's your take?
Well, you can't stop growth, you know. Can't stop development. It's going to happen. People are going to want to come to Flagstaff. It's a friggin' great town. I mean, they're building a hospital just south of Mountain Dell. You probably are.
No, I just heard about that just the other day.
They're huge. I mean, it's a giant thing. And
it's
right by
my house.
Have they
already started construction?
They're surveying. So that's going to really change a lot of stuff. And, you know, you can't stop growth. Path to development. Just go with it, I guess. But, you know, my take on this, I've listened to some of your other podcasts, and you ask people, you know, what is their hope? You know, can we preserve the Grand Canyon and other areas? And it only takes one bad apple. Some guy with a match on a windy day could burn the whole city of Flagstaff. And that's scary stuff. So I don't know. That's the bad side. The good side is education is pretty good in Flagstaff. We have a college here, and the kids get a good education, and that's the key is education.
Yeah, and I think part of that education is introducing them to the raw world. A lot of people in cities and such just don't have the opportunity to realize its tremendous value and stuff. So I agree with your education.
We want to introduce young people to the outdoors so they appreciate it. There's that story of the out at Wapatki. They had a bunch of young teenagers that had gone afoul of the law, and they were trying to show them the outdoors. And one of the counselors was taking a nap, and these two little girls walk up behind him with a huge rock and drop it on his head. They wanted to go to a concert, a scorpion concert.
Oh, my
God. They're going to kill him, steal the truck, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I don't think I want to necessarily do the Hoods in the Woods program.
Did he survive?
Yeah, he just flesh wound.
Had a pretty good headache. Good God. Well, you know, I back in the old days of McCallum, when I worked for McCallum, Grand Canyon Youth Expeditions, there would be a mix of kids that we would have some really overachieving kids mixed with kids that had problems and kids, you know, like the Hoods in the Woods moniker and stuff. And I always felt like that was a much better way to do it rather than have the entire group troubled youth, because they'd feed on each other and make more trouble, where, you know, sometimes the good kids would give a little more balance to the bad kids. But also, I'm sure the bad kids made the good kids bad, too. You know, it's how society is.
It's still worth trying to get them out there.
But it is a great medium for all kids, whether they're good or bad. And I don't think there are bad kids.
No.
They're kids that are troubled. Sometimes there's bad parents. But I think it's a great medium to get kids out. And rivers particularly are a wonderful thing to for somebody to really go, hey, it's between me and the river and not really mess it up with other people or other things. It's a personal relationship you can introduce to them. So I think it's kind of neat that you brought that up.
Well, Grand Canyon Youth is a perfect
example. Yeah, no, it was a great success. They're doing a good job over there, too. Grand Canyon Youth is an organization where they're bringing kids, and they're doing great things up on the San Juan and all over the place, but they do some Grand Canyon trips as well. But it's a neat organization that if you do have some extra money, donate to them. You know, why not?
Yeah.
A little extra money. So, Pete, let's talk a little bit about the bug that put everybody inside this last year. How'd you do? Did you just stay home or?
Yeah. I mean, what else are you going to do?
Do you have your shots?
Oh, yeah. You know, I go out now and I'm wearing a mask and I look around and everyone's taking them off and I'm going, well, I guess I'm still not quite there yet.
No, I'm if I go into a building and I'm still not going out to dinner, I'm still wearing my mask. And some people might look at you because they don't have a mask on and stuff. But I agree with you. I think until herd immunity is at the 75 or 80% of everybody having shots, I mean, it is obviously working. And you know, the statistics show that. But I agree with you. I think keep your masks on, you guys, until we don't have any more spread on this thing.
Well, the summertime is when the flu gets at its lowest rate.
So it might just be a seasonal lull.
It could come back this winter. I don't know.
I appreciate your paranoia. I still have it, but it is looking better and better. It was pretty much getting out of control. But, you know, all along I was saying if it blows up in India, you know, 1.4 billion people that live in real close proximity of each other, and that's happening right now. I'm worried about the people from India for sure because it's going off over there. But I guess, you know, I'd really like to emphasize to the listener the importance of vigilance with this thing because it's still there. It's still out there. And it's good to see that they're starting to get shots in the arms of kids and young people. But if you haven't gotten your shot, come on, you guys. You listen to Big Adventures here. Get the shots. Pete,
why not?
Don't you agree?
I do.
Give us one big adventure from your European travels that stands out.
Wow.
Like, what was your favorite ski area over there?
Well, we skied in Verbier, but also Lausanne, Switzerland.
Yeah.
We had, Breck and I, we got a job as bouncers at a British discotheque.
In Switzerland?
Yeah, in Verbier. There was a group called Muris and Small that brought British young people over to Switzerland, and they were on a ski trip. And they had subsidized alcohol costs. At the bar, you could get a drink for pretty cheap. But they didn't want the Swiss to come in because the Swiss, I don't know, they had to spend extra for a beer and stuff at their locations. So our job was to keep the Swiss people out.
And you were in Switzerland.
But that was totally great. We went a couple years in a row.
I'm trying to visualize you as a bouncer. No, did you ever have angry Swiss people that you were turning away?
I don't think
away?
We ever did anything different than we would have done if we weren't working.
You were bouncers that were drinking cheap beer.
There was a lot of Canadians over there. Because they weren't in the Vietnam War, so they didn't have a draft.
Right.
But we did. But we had high lottery numbers. I did anyway. I'm not sure how Brett got out of it, but it was an exciting
time.
Probably
by going to Switzerland.
We brought one Canadian guy back, a guy named Rob Keeling. We brought him back, and he worked for Hatch for a couple of years. And, you know, it was some good times. We actually were over there that the guy that later started Outside Magazine was over there skiing with us. He was a ski bum. I think his name was, I can't think of it right now. But anyway, he started Outside Magazine, and it was a place called the Vagabond Club in Lausanne, which was like a hiker's, or a mountain climber's club that we actually initially went to.
And cool.
We got a chalet and had a great time.
And you were saying you were over there with Rich Bangs.
No, with Bart.
Oh, with Bart Henderson.
Yeah.
Who we had on an earlier show, a really amazing interview with Bart. But Let's talk a little bit about Rich Bangs and that. He's an old friend of yours.
He's my same age. We were both worked for Hatch back in the 60s. And he always had a dream to go run the Blue Nile. I think he might have actually done that, but which is in the news these days because the Ethiopians are damming it up and going to stop Egypt from getting as much water as they normally
get. Yeah, it's a big controversy.
It's a big controversy. I talked to Rich about it. He said, "Where's Sobek when we need him?" That was his comment, so I don't know what Sobek would do about it. But
Rich Bangs worked for Sobek. Sobek is a...
He started Sobek.
He started it, and really the first international rafting company that really brought rafting to places all over the world. Just because Sobek was going there and doing these exploratory trips and then bringing customers through there and... really an amazing story, Sobek. But Rich Bangs, fantastic fella, and he now, and I'd give a plug to his travel show.
Quest.
Google it up, Rich Bangs, and dial in on his travel show because he does just a fantastic job, really doing some background, behind-the-scenes information about different places and history of places, and it's really a top-notch travel show. So Rich Bangs, there's a call out. And Rich, hopefully you're listening to this podcast. Well, I can't thank you enough, Pete, for sitting in on it with me. And when you look back at our friendship, it's been a remarkable run we've had. And I'm really excited about you going. How long has it been since you've been on the river?
I went the year before last.
Year before. So what kind of trip did you do?
It was a private trip before, but it's the same boat. It's a snout.
Yeah, snout.
Sabah snout with a bimini top. So it's
that's
luxurious.
The snout is two side pontoons with a frame in between them. It's 22 feet long, and it is absolutely one of the best boats down there. Always has been.
The private trip was with Greg Williams and Al Tynes. You know those
guys.
Oh,
yeah. I was invited on that trip.
Yeah, they are good to run with.
I was sorry to miss it, but I bet they were. That must have been a lot of fun. Al Tynes, it was his permit, right? I think so.
I think he had something to do with it.
Yeah, but he's always a barrel of laughs. But, thanks so much for sitting in with us. You've got great insight. I'd like to have you again. There's some other stories that we could dig into that I know about that I've been pretty easy on you in this interview over.
Well, the 83 flood, we had an interesting trip on that.
Yeah.
And there's other stuff we could talk about next time.
No, next time. And that's another really great. I think I might dedicate multiple shows, but one thing I would like to do is sit a group of us down for a show and centralize the subject of the 1983 flood debacle.
Emerald Mile, great book.
And that was a really fun thing talking to the author, and he did a great job on that book. And there's a lot to talk about in regards to the 83. That was truly a big adventure. But thanks for being here. I look forward to our next visit. And you guys, thanks for sitting in, getting to know Pete a little bit. And, stay right side up. This is Big Adventures with Pete Resnick and Brian Durker signing out.
Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures. Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.